the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again. Welcome to the show. Coming up, we hear about an increase in water allocations and also with no one to pick his crop due to a labour shortage and no tourists due to COVID, one strawberry grower has decided to turn the excess fruit into jam.
We've made about 25,000 jars of jam, which is a lot of strawberries.
And if you didn't take this avenue, would that really just be going to waste?
It'd be in the back paddock. As a farmer who puts a lot of time and effort into growing it, it'd break your heart to have to dump it. And I do know there are other strawberry growers that have had to do that because of lockdown.
All that and a whole lot more coming up on the program, and you can always send us a text. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. But first up today, there's been a 14% increase in general security water allocations in the New South Wales Murray, bringing the allocation for general security licences up to 44% today. Irrigators have been calling for an increase as the dams are near capacity, but Water New South Wales has been preserving water in the system to meet demand for a large amount of carryover and also to pay back environmental water from the Barmer Millawa Forest, which has been borrowed by irrigators over the last 5 dry years. Allocations, though, in the Murrumbidgee, they stayed at the same amount at 52%. Well, irrigation farmers in the Murray River Valley have welcomed the increase of 14% for general security water to that new level. Lachlan Marshall is the vice chair of the Murray Regional Strategy Group. He's got a dairy farm at Blighty in the state's south, and he told Simon Wallace, with the dams and rivers full, they should be given bigger allocations.
Look, it gives us a hope that there's some common sense coming back to this allocation process.
And what are your concerns about the allocations?
Well, concerns are we have a system that's 100% full. So we have a Hume Weir, which is full, Dartmouth, which is over 75%. We have Menindee Lakes, which are at 100%, and we were told that allocations were going to languish at 30% until possibly as late as February, which created a huge spike in the temporary trade market. The New South Wales Water, the Environment Department was found to be selling water on the market at that point in time, and that's water we as producers begged to have access to during the drought, and we were told that it couldn't sell that water. It seems when we have a spill on the way, that water can be sold for profit, which has been disappointing to us all. But really, we should be seeing a technical spill. We should see carryover wiped and 100% allocations instated across Victoria and New South Wales.
What would the carryover being wiped do for you, Lachlan?
Well, look, I'll lose the water that I've carried over. Yes, I carried water over for this season. I'll lose that. But what it does mean is that there's an acknowledgement for the health of the system, the health of the catchment, its acknowledgement of the inflows, and that we should receive 100% allocation. Therefore, if we don't reach that situation, I think it's just another signal of a failing of the management of the basin plan.
At 30%, how much did that cost you to run your dairy?
At 30%, I would have had to have purchased it in at a minimum of another 30%, and that would have been at the behest of wherever the water market was at that point in time. I needed a minimum of 60 just to survive, let alone be able to put enough feed away to insulate against future droughts and inflow hardships.
Do you have high security water or you're all on general, Lachlan?
New South Wales Murray is general security. There is very little, if it's rare as hen's teeth, high security in the Murray Irrigation District. It was set up that way for annual cropping such as rice, wheat, irrigating wheat and cereal crops, growing fodder for stock. This was originally set up not as a high security area, such as the Murrumbidgee in the north, which has permanent plantations.
So you're at 44 this morning and you need 60. How does the market look with a pretty wet spring?
I firmly believe we should be on 100. There should be the technical spill should have happened, taking into account those aforementioned totals in the catchment. And that those are ongoing. You know, the Darling is going to contribute well into the new year with flows there, and hopefully we see some good falls throughout the Darling Barker catchment that continues to see those lakes remain full, and contribute. South Australia's on 100%. The Lower Lakes are all full. Lake Victoria's healthy. Therefore, there's plenty of resource that should be redistributed.
That was Blighty dairy farmer Lachlan Marshall, who's also vice chair of the Murray Regional Strategy Group. The new level today, 44%. He says it should be 100%. You might have some thoughts on that as well. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. Well, let's stay with water issues. And over the last 25 years, cotton growers have almost halved the water needed to grow one bale of cotton. Research from New South Wales Department of Primary Industries shows that water usage has fallen from 1.3 megalitres per bale to just 0.74 megalitres a bale in 2020. Now, Michael Murray from Cotton Australia says this has been driven primarily through improvements in irrigation infrastructure and also management efficiencies underpinned by research and development in new varieties as well. He says that cotton is often misrepresented when it comes to water use.
Yeah, if we go back since about 1995, we're almost using half the amount of water to grow a bale of cotton. So that's great news. And not only does it go back that length of time, it's a continuous process. We've scored goals in the last 5 years, and we're hoping to score some further goals in the next 5 years.
But it is going to taper off, though, isn't it? I mean, you can't sort of achieve the big gains you have from the past.
You are probably right. We're still hoping to have an improvement roughly in the order of 2 to 3% a year. It is going to be a tough ask, but we've been making progress and we intend to continue making progress.
But I guess the thing is that, has it been breeding? Has it been, channeling or, you know, less evaporation? What's been the secret?
A combination of all of those, Michael. The key thing here is that we actually try to measure everything that comes on farm, be it irrigation water or rainfall. So some of the, and so it's not just what we apply onto the paddock, so some of the big gains have been reducing evaporation from storages, certainly improved yields, improved management, just getting more fibre for every drop that is applied has made a big difference. Better irrigation layout, adoption of some different systems that provide, improved efficiency. And I'll make a point there that there's no one system that suits every environment. So it is horses and courses, but if people can improve or put a better system in for themselves, that's going to make a real difference as well.
But how much more cotton do we grow now from when we were looking at it in 1995?
Well, we're basically growing twice as much lint for every megalitre of water applied.
The Australian crop of cotton is much bigger now than it was in 95, though, isn't it?
Yes, although interestingly, in the last decade, we've had both the biggest crop on record, which I think was 2011-12 at about 5.3 million bales, and just two full seasons ago, we certainly had the smallest crop in something like 40 years of 600,000 bales. So, look, on average, yes, we're growing more cotton now than what we were in the mid-90s.
Right. And I guess the thing is that, how much expansion can there be of that, given the tension? There's obviously tension about the amount of water we've got to use for productive agriculture.
Well, a couple of points there. Within our core growing areas, which are not exclusively, but largely within the Murray-Darling Basin, there simply isn't any additional water. So any improvements, any increase in production that we get in those areas has to be driven by greater efficiency because there is no more water. The second thing is that we'll just keep applying. And we've got to bear in mind that irrigators are allocated so much water a year, depending on the rules and depending on the season, and it's their job then to make the most of that water. Now, from our point of view, from a cotton-producing perspective, we want them to be as efficient as possible with that water that they're allocated. And the other misconception of the industry is that we're a thirsty crop. If you grow a cotton crop next to a sorghum crop, next to a maize crop, in the same climate, same soil, you're going to use virtually the same amount of water per hectare.
Now, so where can the expansion happen? Is it going to happen in the north, in northern Australia?
Well, there's certainly lots of real interest and real interest that has been converted into real investment. So we believe across northern Australia, which is obviously a huge area, we think there could be upwards of 20 to 25,000 hectares grown in the coming season. Now, to put that in perspective, that the rest of the national crop is probably going to be in the order of 350 to 400,000 hectares, so it's still a relatively small amount, but it's the amount that's growing. We know that construction, at least site works, had started on a cotton gin around Katherine in the Northern Territory, and there seems to be, I don't think a deal has been done as such, but there's certainly very strong speculation that one will follow in the Kununurra district in the not too distant future as well.
Michael Murray from Cotton Australia, and on the issue, we're just looking at the water allocations, and we're hearing from that Blighty dairy farmer Lachlan Marshall saying that the rate at 44% should be 100% because the dams are full and the rivers are high. Alan at Cooters texted in saying irrigators just don't get it. Just because the dams are full, it doesn't mean it should be sold to them. The environment needs the water, particularly next autumn when the country will probably be dry. And on the strawberries, of course, excess strawberries, no one picked them and turning them into jam. Larry says they should take the excess strawberries and they should be dumped in Macquarie Street at the feet of Gladys as proof of the damage of their restrictions. It's 16 minutes past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, 55 years is a long relationship in anyone's book, and it's also the length of one's stellar career in the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries. Tamworth plant pathologist Dr. Kevin Moore has decided it's time to say goodbye to his career that's spanning 5 decades. Over that time, he's achieved a great deal, and he's made a huge difference to the pulse and grains industry. And he sat down with Lara Webster to reflect on where it all began.
Well, Lara, I grew up on a 6-acre farm, Soldier Settlement Farm, just out of Liverpool in Sydney. I went to Hurlston Agricultural High School, where I was introduced to agriculture, and then to Sydney University, where I did ag science, majoring in plant pathology. I was a trainee with the Department of Agriculture, which meant that I had to work for the government for 4 or 5 years after I graduated. So I started working at the department's facility at Rydalmere near Parramatta in 1969. Yeah, I started with the department actually on the 14th of February 1966, Decimal Currency Day. I remember that quite clearly. And then I did a PhD at Washington State University from 1975 to 1978. And I came back to Rydalmere and moved to Tamworth in 1980, and I've been here ever since.
What was it about plant pathology that really drew you?
One of my uncles was a dairy microbiologist in Werribee in Victoria, and I used to go down and visit him once a year, and he introduced me to the microscopic world. He worked on the microbiology of milk, and so I got to play with microscopes, and I was fascinated by the microscopic world. And plus, we had some very good lecturers at the University of Sydney in the Faculty of Agriculture, and it was their passion and their skills as teachers and mentors that basically seduced me into plant pathology.
You've achieved much in your time, Kevin Moore, but one of the big things that a lot of people do talk about and remember you for and the assistance you gave was, of course, to the national response to the Ascochyta outbreak in the 1990s. Take me back to that time. What do you remember about that response and being involved in that?
Well, I didn't actually work on chickpeas in 1998 when Ascochyta blight caused widespread damage to the eastern Australian chickpea industry. But I'd been to Syria in 1996 and 1997, and I'd actually seen Ascochyta in chickpeas in the nurseries at Akada. So I knew what it looked like. And Dallas Parsons was an agronomist, the late Dallas Parsons, an agronomist at Moree, and he rang me up and he said, I've got those chickpeas out Gurley Way, and he said they'd look like they've had a flamethrower put for them. And I knew exactly, I knew immediately what it was. I said, I'll be up there tomorrow. So I went up there, and sure enough, it was Ascochyta blight in the chickpeas, and all the varieties back then were very, very susceptible. 1998 was a highly conducive season, like 2021 is. And so that's how I got into chickpeas, chickpea pathology, through Ascochyta blight and then Phytophthora.
And what are some of the other big things that you've achieved and some of the things that stand out to you?
Mostly, Lara, I've been fortunate in within the DPI. I've had excellent managers and some fantastic colleagues. Now we've got the young Hayley over there, who's got, she's going to take the gavel, and then she'll be very good. But I've really enjoyed working with farmers and agronomists. You know, I've spent a lot of time talking with them, walking their crops with them, sharing times with their families, getting to know, you know, the dogs. They don't bark at me anymore. The children. It was that welcoming, I guess, that kept my passion going, and I thought, this is a pretty good job, you know, when you're working in an environment like that. We've seen a share of droughts and floods. You know, I guess I would have seen at least six of each since 1980. But farmers are tough. I mean, they take it in their stride. And, you know, they'll get through droughts and then they get a flood. And they're still hanging in there if they can afford it.
What do you think the future may hold for young plant pathologists and other staff in the DPI in the next few decades?
Well, plant pathology is a great vocation, particularly in broadacre agriculture, because it means you're out in a paddock in healthy environment. Some of the places I go to, they're absolutely magnificent. You know, and you can't beat wandering around in a chickpea paddock at 8 o'clock in the morning in August when it's not too cold, not too hot, no flies. It's just a fantastic, peaceful time of day, and it allows you to focus on the job at hand.
So what's retirement look like? Kevin Moore, what's on the cards?
Well, Lara, I hope to learn an Aboriginal language. It's always been a desire of mine to learn the local language, and we're in Kamilaroi country here, and I think there's a place in town where you can learn that. So that's one thing I'd like to tick off, and I'd also like to do some volunteer teaching in mathematics or English. And then I've got gardening and a few hobbies at home to keep me out of mischief.
So he's going to be busy. Plant pathologist Dr. Kevin Moore speaking there to Lara Webster, and of course we wish him well in his retirement. 55 years with the department. It's coming up to 23 minutes past 12. Got a few texts on the strawberries, the excess strawberries. Jason says, why can't we feed all the strawberries to cows and then get lots of strawberry milk? But David in Trundle says, we have our major supermarket sprouting about how they care for our farmers. Pick up any house brand jar of jam and you'll see where it comes from. It's usually from a European country. Double standards and lip service, says Dave. It's coming up to 24 minutes past 12. Well, let's turn our attention to bushfires now, and scientists are not convinced that the farm boundary legislation that we've been talking about on the program the last couple of days to reduce the risk of bushfire will do anything except encourage land clearing. Landholders can now clear a 25-metre strip around their boundary, and academics say that's currently where many endangered plants and animals live, and they must be preserved. Associate Professor Matt Crowther at the University of Sydney's School of Life and Environmental Sciences says the legislative changes are not based on science and they were not recommended by any experts at any bushfire inquiry.
Well, I think the problem is that there's been a lot of land clearing, especially with changes in legislation over the last few years. There's really, really higher rates than there's been in over 10 years, whatever have been in the last couple of years of land clearing. Now, I know that, you know, especially for property protection and asset protection, you know, they want a sort of simplified areas as breaks. But the problem is, this didn't come from the recommendations of the Bushfires Inquiry, and there's no scientific evidence. In fact, there's evidence that land clearing in these type of areas will dramatically affect I said there's a lot of species, native flora and fauna, and particularly certain species in a lot of rural areas.
So you think that the jury is out on the science?
The science is, well, the recommendations haven't been made of science. That's the thing. The science is there on land clearing and loss of habitat. The science is not there on how effective that these will be as fire protections. Again, they weren't, as there's a lot of experts in the New South Wales inquiry, and it wasn't a recommendation.
And you think that the risk is that the risk to flora and fauna is greater by clearing more land?
Absolutely, because that's where the habitat is. And you've got to remember that, especially with boundaries in rural areas, that's actually some of the remnants of that habitat, because, you know, you've got paddocks and, you know, you've got either crops or you've got livestock in these paddocks. And a lot of areas along boundaries is where basically a lot of the native vegetation remains and, you know, a lot of certain species provide habitat for certain species.
Well, what about the argument that, you know, threatened species and remnant vegetation can be maintained in national parks?
Oh, the problem, there's a real major problem here. National parks, historically, were chosen for basically not only great views, but also different types of land management. Now, rural lands, particularly where certain species live, and even species such as koalas are really known, but they don't live in much of the Blue Mountains, for example, even though there's eucalypt trees, because they like the flat lands and they like the fertile lands, which are preferred by farmers, of course.
So the farmland, they're happier to live on the farmland, in a tree in the farmland.
They are, because they're higher quality trees, i.e. the soil affects the nitrogen and carbon ratio, so they produce, I suppose, more food. And so there's a lot of species and there's a lot of habitat. Like, it's not been random clearing of habitat. The habitat's been cleared, preferably on the flatter areas and in, I suppose, the more fertile areas, because that's the areas that are good for farming. If you look at where a lot of the national parks, like I said, they're great views because they're often on steep bits that you can't farm.
Now, the argument, though, from farmers is that they can slow down the fire if they've got these breaks. They can stop the fires from being so devastating. They can stop some of these wholesale killing that we saw of koalas in the 2019-2020 bushfires. What's your reaction to that?
Well, again, there's problems in this, in that if you basically clear everything, like, well, there's nothing for things to live in. So in those areas, particularly on rural properties, there aren't, well, like you said, you'll stop the cars being killed by fire because they've got nowhere to live. Like, that's not even an argument.
They
like,
won't be there anyway.
Yeah, if you chop down all the trees, you won't get fires killing the koalas because there's no trees for the koalas to live in. And that's the problem with these sort of arguments, that there is areas of them, and it's so vital. And again, when we say farmers, it's a diverse community, farmers. I've worked with farmers, and they're very pro, a lot of them are very pro conservation, very pro, like, bush paddocks and, you know, conservation agreements, and, you know, because we've got to protect that fauna. And often they supply actually very useful, what we call ecosystem services. Pollinators live in there. I was talking to farmers, and, oh, yeah, my crops do better because pollinators, like insects, live in these remnant areas. There's also things such as spiders and a whole lot of things that control a lot of the pest species. Even things such as mouse plagues, when you've got owls and snakes, and you've got a whole lot of things using these remnant areas, they're the ones that often can help farmers. They affect, basically, the water cycles. They affect a whole lot of things that are quite positive, not just for wildlife, but again, for what we call ecosystem services, which are important for farms too.
So you think that the legislation, the gist of this legislation is actually goes counter to what you'd like to see, which is shelter belts, remnant vegetation, you know, parts of the farm that are left for habitat.
Yes, yes. And because this is a particular area along boundaries that often has remnant vegetation, that's the thing. I don't think it should be like a, you know, as the legislation is, you should just go clear it all. Again, maybe there's a case for it, but then there should be proper environmental impact statements for that to see if you are basically damaging habitat.
And which is not part of the legislation currently.
It's not part of the legislation currently, no. There's got to be, you know, not even compromise. It's got to be sensible, science-based solutions.
But a lot of farmers say, it's my land, I should be allowed to do what I want on it.
Well, you know, that's sort of an argument. Like, how could you argue like a koala living on a land or something like that, saying, oh, this is my land, koalas can't buy land, you know? It's not really a valid argument. These are certain species that occur on these remnant vegetation. You can get into a whole lot of sort of arguments about that, whether it's my land and I get to do what I want. It's certainly not a valid argument at all. It's, you know, you have to basically preserve the heritage and the natural resources of New South Wales and Australia.
That's Associate Professor Matt Crowther at the University of Sydney talking about those that farm boundary legislation and trying to reduce the risk of bushfire there. He's obviously not in favour of that idea. It's 29 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. I've got a few texts on the strawberries, making the strawberry jam. Someone's texted in saying, I used to make my own strawberry jam, but buying them in the trays is, because you can only buy them in those little packs, so it makes the jam too dear to make. Well, on the north coast, mid-north coast, they've got plenty of excess strawberries up there, and that's why they're making the jam. 25,000 jars of jam they've made so far, and I think that's they're only just getting started. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's, as I said, 28 minutes to one. It's time for some news headlines now with Adam Story. Good afternoon. Who's new, partial to a bit of strawberry jam?
I love a bit of strawberry jam, actually. So that's the new strawberry jam capital, is it?
At the moment, it is, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right, yeah.
All right. As soon as lockdown's
over. Well, they've got no one to pick it, and they've got no tourists to go and pick them and to pick your own farm. So they thought, well, let's make it into jam.
Oh, you're allowed to do that, just turn up to a farm.
Yeah,
that's
quite common. Yeah, oh, okay. That you do that. I think you know there's a certain amount you pay, and they give you a pallet, and away you go.
Off you go.
Yeah, okay. That's right.
There you go. All right. On to the news. The state's reached a milestone of 80% of the eligible population being vaccinated with at least one dose of a COVID vaccine. Now, the Premier is saying as a result of that, she's now prepared to lift the evening curfew imposed on the 12 Sydney local government areas. That'll be lifted from midnight tonight. It had been in place to stop people leaving their homes for non-essential reasons between 9 and 5 a.m. However, the state has still recorded 1,259 new locally acquired cases, and 12 people have died in hospital in the latest reporting period. And after a year of being COVID-free, New South Wales Health has confirmed two positive cases are now in the state's Riverina region. And Surf Lifesaving New South Wales says three Illawarra-based clubs south of Sydney will not resume patrols this weekend due to safety concerns about coronavirus. Last week, Port Kembla announced its volunteers were not prepared to patrol the beach until vaccination rates in the community are higher and as more is done to protect lifesavers against COVID. And I was sad to hear the news of comedian Norm Macdonald dying at the age of 61. He had a 9-year fight with cancer, but still kept on working during that period. Came to fame during his work in the 1990s on Saturday Night Live. And some great impressions, often push the boundaries.
That's right. And a favourite on David Letterman's show as well.
Him and Dave were quite close. In fact, he used to do an impression of David Letterman on Saturday
right,
Night Live.
He did too. And he hosted a program there for a while until they got upset about the fact that he was always poking fun at O.J. Simpson. And that was the reason he got the sack in the end.
If you go on the YouTube, the hell he used to give OJ.
It's actually very, it's worth looking at. It's very funny. And as everyone says, it was quite a different comic, very sort of straight.
Very dry.
Yeah, very dry.
And if a joke died, that was just as much fun for him as if it was.
Didn't like that one.
He loved getting booed.
Yeah, that's right.
But his style of delivery was something very, very unique.
And he used to team up quite a bit with Will Ferrell in the early days as well. They were very funny together. Worth watching on YouTube if you get the chance.
Absolutely.
All right, thanks for that. Adam Story there with Comedy News. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's time to find out what's happening with the weather, and we're joined now by Dave Wilkie at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. How are you going?
Good. So has all the rain moved out now and fine conditions in most of the state now?
Yeah, in general. We're still seeing the odd shower about coastal parts. It's more sort of concentrated about the lower Hunter and lower parts of the Macquarie Coast. So generally not seen a lot since 9 a.m. But yeah, in the 24 hours to 9 a.m, highest totals we got were generally around that region as well. Carey's Peak, Barrington Tops got the highest, got 61 mils. But yeah, it has mostly cleared out, and that's because we have a high pressure system which is starting to move over, and that low that formed offshore is now moving. It's brushed just past Lord Howe Island, so they got some pretty good gusts and a bit of rain out there, but generally, yeah, moving away. So fairly clear conditions expected for most of the state for today and tomorrow. Might still see a few lingering showers about some coastal parts through the course of today and tomorrow, but generally pretty light. And yeah, it's not until Friday and Saturday that we start to see that next system that moves in from the west. So that's potentially got a bit of rainfall with it as it starts to sweep over the state on Friday into Saturday.
Yes, tell us about that system. So what can we expect in terms of rainfall and where?
Yeah, generally going to be about western and southern parts on the Friday. Might see some good thunderstorms actually on the Friday, particularly in the far west, so decent gusty storms moving through on that day. But then when we move into Saturday, that's when most of the rainfall is going to move to be about, southern parts of the state, so around the Alps, southwest slopes, but also stretching up into the central west, western plains areas. So this stage is probably looking like a little bit less rainfall than was expected yesterday for this system. I think a few millimetres through parts of the central west and western plains is still possible over sort of the course of, mostly Saturday for that area. But the bulk of the rainfall with this next system is expected about the south of the state. So the Alps, southwest slopes is going to be the focus again. And yeah, over the course of Saturday and then with persistent showers that are expected to follow Sunday and then another front on Monday, probably get some good totals through that area. So probably a bit of snow about the Alps again, but generally, yeah, I think we could see parts of the southwest slope sort of getting in that sort of 10 to 15, 10 to 20 millimetre mark across the, sort of over 3 days from, say, Friday. And fairly similar numbers for the Eastern Riverina. So yeah, we could get a little bit of rain through eastern parts of the Riverina, but the bulk of the rainfall really going to be about the higher country of the southwest slopes and the Alpine, and then most other areas that will get anything will just be a few drops. So we'll see a few drops through the Riverina, through broad area of the western plains and up through the northwest slopes and plains, but it's really not going to be a whole lot.
Right, but some useful rain in the central west, Riverina maybe, and less as you go further north, I guess.
Yeah, and it becomes patchier in general. So there'll be places that'll miss out through the north of the state, but generally through southern parts, I think we'll get some showers and storms moving through mostly on the Saturday.
Okay, David, thanks for that.
Thanks.
It's 22 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Got a few texts on the land clearing or the bushfire break issue. Someone's texted in, I've got a 100-acre bush block that's surrounded by national parks and forests, and they're saying all a fire break at that size will do is give him false sense of security. And but Philip at Mudgee says, if you have a cleared paddock, as old mate says, or the scientist we were talking to, Matt Crowther, was saying, do you really think that the farmers are going to clear the boundary of those trees that they know are important? You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 22 minutes to one. Well, here's a subject that's close to my heart. The unexpected sale of one of the country's largest independent brewers, Stone and Wood, to beer giant Lion has shocked the sector. Beer industry analyst and writer Matt Kierkegaard says that the sale of the parent company Fermentum has left a bad taste in his mouth. He told Kim Honan it's damaged the independent brewing sector and smaller brewers will find it harder to grow using the flag of independence.
It's fair to say I was, yeah. We've seen businesses taken over more and more frequently over the last few years. And so the shock value of each sale had been a little bit less. But in the case of Stone and Wood, they had so loudly protested that they were going to stay independent and had criticised others for making the same decision. That, you know, many of us who observed the industry had come to believe that they were going to be able to do what they said that they would.
Well, it's always so controversial when an indie sells to a major. Like you said, we saw it with Four Pines, Pirate Life, and then with Bolter, and even this announcement's drawn plenty of criticism online from beer lovers. But what about within the independent beer sector? Has there been a bit of a backlash there, or is there some sort of happiness for the team?
There was a lot of shock as people processed what they were hearing. And the conversations that I've had and the things that I've seen and, you know, and read are that on one hand, there is a lot of affection for the business, but at the same time, people feel a little bit shocked and let down. And they're trying to accept the justifications because it makes it easier for them to accept what has happened. It's really, really interesting to watch the way people are responding to this, because it's unlike any of the other sales that we've seen, that, you know, people go, oh, well, it was going to happen. But this was a business that had always held itself out as being different and better and more able to continue as an independent company. At one stage, their CEO described them as a 100-year company.
So what do you think this sale does mean for independent brewers, and what impact is it likely to have on the sector?
Look, I think people that genuinely care about independence, it will be of benefit to brewers, because they'll switch their allegiance to other brewers. But as a wider thing, I think what it says is that you can't be an independent business and grow. And if you try and say that you will, people are going to be really, really cynical about the claims you're making. And I think that really, really sets back the independence cause.
Matt Kierkegaard is an industry analyst and writer. He's the editor of Australian Brews News, and the ACCC is saying that it will commence a public review of Lion's proposed acquisition of Fermentum in due course. It's coming up to 18 minutes to one. Well, a dispute between the biggest beef exporting and the biggest beef buying countries is heating up after an investigation of two cases of atypical BSE, also known as mad cow disease, in Brazil. Those investigations were finalised. Trade had been expected to start again with China this week. However, meat industry analyst Simon Quilty says that's now unlikely, as other countries have signed up to ban Brazilian beef.
The situation between Brazil and China has taken a turn for the worst. In the eyes of the Brazilians, that suspension date should have started September the 3rd. But in the eyes of the Chinese, it's shipments after September the 3rd. So that 6 days could represent anywhere between 20,000 to 30,000 metric tons of product that gets into the system that the Chinese will not accept. It does put a cloud of doubt, I think, over when the lifting of the suspension or ban, call it what you may, will occur. Originally, we thought it was going to be at the end of this week, but there's no doubt to me that this will probably see an extension of the lifting of that ban.
And now other countries are getting involved?
Yes, they are. So to date, we have officially China, Indonesia, Russia, and Saudi Arabia. And market sources tell me that in addition, there's now Egypt and Iran. But to put things in perspective, these five other countries only make up 7% of Brazil's total beef exports. So the overall market impact, though concerning, is not going to be, you know, enormous. But it's the principle, I think, and the attention that it draws that is the concern for exporters and producers in Brazil.
Simon Quilty from Global Agri Trends was talking there to Warwick Long.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, the New South Wales Bushfires Coronial Inquiry is today hearing details of how a fire tornado upturned a 10-ton fire truck and killed volunteer firefighter Samuel McPaul. Our reporter Jess Clifford has been following the evidence and joins us now. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So quite extraordinary evidence by the sound of things today.
Yeah, that's right. So what we were really hearing about today, as you know, a follow-on from yesterday, was this fire tornado that formed. It's a very unusual and rare weather event, and it descended into a gully where Samuel McPaul and his firefighting crew were fighting some spot fires and overran their truck. So essentially what we heard this morning was from a number of RFS members who were around at the time and watching this unfold. They didn't see a lot, to be honest, those that weren't on the truck, because everything just went so dark and the air was so smoky that they really couldn't see through, but they knew that the fire truck was there and they knew that it may have been overrun. We're just at the moment hearing evidence from Rodney O'Keefe. He was one of the RFS members on the truck, and in a statement that was read out earlier today, he sort of described being on the truck when a wall of flames suddenly appeared in front of them. They'd really only been in this location for a couple of minutes, and they'd decided to actually turn around and head back towards the property they were protecting. And it was flat ground on a paddock. And as they were driving, yeah, he just said this wall of flames appeared in front of them. And, you know, we heard that it wasn't any error from the driver or anything they could have done. It's just what they'd actually done was thought they were driving through a spot fire and driven into the eye of a fire tornado. So that's where we got to this morning.
The fire tornado, which upturned the 10-ton fire truck. And normally, I mean, the accepted wisdom is that that's the safest place to be, inside the fire truck when the fire goes through, but it was picked up and basically tossed around.
Yeah, that's right. So what we heard is that they drove into the eye of this fire tornado and realised that they were surrounded by fire, and the driver sort of described in his statement that the fire truck lifted from the right-hand passenger corner. And he felt the whole truck flip on its head. And the driver was in the cabin and managed to crawl out because the windscreen was completely blown out. So he was able to get out quite easily, relatively uninjured. But his two crew members, one of them, Rodney O'Keefe, who we're hearing from now, suffered quite severe burns. He was trying to take shelter in the crew protection area on the back, but suffered quite significant burns and injuries as a result of that, some cracked ribs as well. And we heard that Samuel McPaul was unfortunately trapped underneath that crew protection area, and they could not access him.
And some other evidence coming about this fire tornado from other people as well. The RFS captain due to give evidence later too, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So we are hearing evidence from a number of RFS members who were there assisting on the day. And what we've been hearing from them, also police officers as well, what we're hearing from them is just, I guess, what it was like for them to hear about this news, having to call for assistance on the radio and, you know, trying desperately to get Samuel McPaul out from underneath that truck without any success. So, yeah, we will hear from a few more people this afternoon, and I imagine this inquest will also be going into tomorrow as well.
Yes, some very sad evidence indeed, and quite shocking as well. But thanks for that, Jess.
No worries. Thanks, Michael.
Jess Clifford there at the New South Wales Bushfire Coronial Inquiry, focusing on the death of volunteer firefighter Samuel McPaul. It's coming up to 12 minutes to 1 here on the New South Wales Country Hour.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, you may have seen the devastating scenes of strawberry growers around the country spraying their crops as prices drop below the cost of production, spraying out their crops. Well, Anthony Sarks owns a pick-your-own strawberry farm on the New South Wales mid-north coast, and he's been hit hard by the lockdown with no locals or visitors allowed on the farm for the past 3 weeks, just as peak harvest started. Thousands upon thousands of strawberries looked like they would have to go to waste, but the grower had a different idea. Keely Johnson filed this report.
Thousands
Thousands of ripe red strawberries are being turned into jam, bottled up at a local factory here in Port Macquarie that specialises in chutneys, spreads, oils and more. And it's all come about because of the oversupply of fruit at Anthony Sark's Pick Your Own Strawberry Farm.
Because of the lockdown, we were coinciding with our big flush of strawberries. The Sydney lockdown started the eve of the school holidays in July, which knocked us. And the regional lockdown started on the eve of our big strawberry flush, which is August, September. And as I say, that's when we get our big flush of tourists and visitors to pick the strawberries. And, of course, this year that just didn't happen.
How many strawberries would you say each season you've got growing on your farm?
Well, there's about 140,000 plants. The yields vary, of course, because of different times of the year and different growing conditions. But look, we've made about 25,000 jars of jam, which is a lot of strawberries.
And if you didn't take this avenue, would that really just be going to waste?
It'd be in the back paddock. As a farmer who puts a lot of time and effort into growing it, it'd break your heart to have to dump it. And I do know there are other strawberry growers that have had to do that because of lockdown, and other horticulture growers. We make strawberry jam out of our seconds anyway, but I just couldn't do it. So we thought, well, we'll take the punt, make all this jam and worry about selling it later.
And, you know, with jam, that's kind of more of a long-lasting product, so it's something that you can have a bit of time to actually get consumers to come over and purchase?
Oh, yes, there's going to be some cheap strawberry jam out at Ricardo's in the near future, folks. So weighing all of those things up, we said, well, let's take the punt, let's do it, we'll sell it.
But you did say as well, you are saving the product, but it's still costing you money to turn your product now into jam, is that correct?
Absolutely. Well, it's a double whammy for any businessman if you miss out on income. So we've missed out on the income during the lockdown, but the double whammy is we now have to pay to have it made into jam. So it's a double loss. But having said that, in the long term, it'll be worth it. It'll just take a bit of marketing effort.
And it's a pretty fantastic factory you've got here. What's the relationship you've got here with Eric, the chef, I believe, that's making it all for you?
Yeah, well, the other chef, Fine Foods, and us, it's a great marriage. He obviously contract bottles for lots of other people as well. But we came together when we first started business. Eric was making products in his garage. We thought, well, let's get together and you take all of our second-grade fruit and bring us back the finished product. And it's grown into quite a business, as you can see here. This is a big factory.
Yeah.
And, you know, it employs a lot of people. And businesses beget other businesses.
Eric Robertson is the owner of the Other Chef Makers and Providors in Port Macquarie. He says he actually made his very first jam using Anthony's strawberries almost 15 years ago with just a 1970s electric stove and 12-litre pot.
I started in my granny flat. I was teaching at TAFE as a teacher, working in a local restaurant as well and doing this as a hobby. And this kind of eventually just took over. We started making strawberry jam for Ricardo's. I think it was 50 jars the first week in my little 12-litre pot. We were cutting out the labels. And from there, I mean, we've just done 25,000 in 10 days, I think it is.
How long ago did you start? And, you know, was one of your first ever products with Ricardo's?
Yes, for contract manufacturing it was. So I made a strawberry jam. It won a medal at the Fine Food Show in Sydney. Anthony, of course, grabbed hold of that in the media that had won an award. He gave me a call and he said, when are you going to make that for me? And I said, I'll be out there in 5 minutes. So driving out to the farm, the light bulb went off and went, okay, evaluating for the primary producer is key. Their second grade produce. I knew living in the area here in the Hastings, there's a lot of growers that have seconds and also as a chef in the industry. So basically we started working with Ricardo's from there, and as they grew, we built another factory to keep up with them, and then we've got new customers as well coming on board, which we're super excited about. So, you know, we're quite a small artisan manufacturer, but still the consumer wants that consistency, and that's good. That makes us lift our game and make sure that we get the right equipment so that we get that consistency across the board. And it's a lot of hard work, but I love making strawberry jam.
That was Eric Robertson, the owner of The Other Chef, finishing that report by Keely Johnson. It's time for markets. Let's go to Casino Cattle and Doug Robson.
Good afternoon. There was 1,027 head yarded. That's down by 150. Young cattle made up a large percentage of the yarding, and there was a good supply of cows. Quality was fairly good in a strong market, although odd sales were a little easy depending on quality. Restock a winner steer sold from 516 to 770 cents for the lightweights, while winner heifers ranged from 500 to 748. Restock a yearling steer sold from 452 to 610 cents, and feeder steers 414 to 506 cents. Restock yearling heifers sold from 440 to 580 cents. Only a few bullocks and steers, and they sold from 372 to 400 cents, and the grown heifers topped at 370. Cows were 5 to 6 cents dearer. Three score medium weights averaged 379 cents. Heavy cows 389 to 402. PTIC cows back to the paddock sold up to 478 cents. This is Doug Robson at Casino.
Carcourt Sheep and Lambs, David Monk.
Good afternoon. Numbers are up a little for a yarding of 3,370 lambs. It was a mixed yarding with a fair selection of new season lambs to suit both the processors and restockers. There were very limited numbers of heavyweight lambs, and the old trade lamb quality was only fair. Trade weight new season lambs were $7 dearer, selling from $1.98 to $2.33, to average between $9.30 and $9.40 cents a kilogram. Trade weight old lambs were up to $15 cheaper with quality a factor. Trade weight old lambs sold from $1.60 to $2.48. The heavyweight lambs were also cheaper, with the lambs over 24 kilograms selling from $2.24 to $2.70. A single pen of heavyweight new season lambs sold for $2.60. Merino lambs are $5 cheaper, with the trade weight selling from $1.50 to $2.08. Lambs to the restockers were dearer, selling from $1.20 to $1.88. Hoggets sold to $2.30. There were 2,120 mostly good quality mutton yarded, where most grades were 6 to 11 dearer. Merino ewes sold from $70 to $2.10, while crossbred ewes sold from $1.30 to $2.20. Merino weathers sold from $146 to $200. This is David Monk at CTLX for MLA.
Let's go to Cowra Sheep and Lambs now, and Rob Pearce.
Good afternoon, Michael. There were 4,300 lambs, down by 1,200. Quality was once again good for the 3,800 new seasons, with mainly trade weights penned. Medium and heavy trade new seasons were firm, 20 to 22 kilos, sold from 200 to 226, 22 to 24, 225 to 236, averaging 9.30 to 9.60 cents. Heavies were firm to a couple cheaper, 24 to 26, 239 to 259, 26 to 30, 260 to 276, averaging 9.20 to 9.40. Heavy old lambs E7, 24 to 26, 230 to 244, 26 plus 269 to a top of 292, averaging 830 to 900 cents. And stores sold from 135 to 178, and mutton numbers fell for 770. Quality varied. Heavy first cross ewes sold from 180 to 214, averaging 580 to 630 cents. And this has been Rob Pearce from MLA at Cowra.
Thanks, Rob. Let's go to Yass Sheep and Lambs and Graham Richard.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers lifted to 5,500 and included 2,600 new season lambs. The quality of the new season lambs was good, with lambs 20 to 24 kilos best supplied. The old lamb quality was very mixed, and there were plenty of light merinos. The market trend cheaper, with the exception of the lighter merinos. The new season trades eased 2 to 8, 201 to 227 on 9.10 to 9.50 cents on average. The heavies were back 6 to 10, 238 to 250, with extra heavies 253 to 275 and averaged 9.40. The old trades 188 to 236 or 8.90 to 9.20 cents. The heavy weights 223 to 270, with extra heavy old lambs reaching 296. Light restocking merino lambs 140 to 164. Mutton numbers lifted to 3,700, and medium and heavy crossbred ewes and merino weathers made up the bulk. Prices were firm to dearer. Heavy crossbred ewes 173 to 255. Merino weathers 183 to 226. And this has been Graham Richard at Yass.
And to Mossvale Cattle now, and David Kent.
Good afternoon. Numbers increased for a total yarding of 541 fair to good quality cattle. Yearling steers were well supplied, including some excellent pens of ideal heavy feeder steers, along with some well-finished lines to suit the processors. There were some good runs of weaners returning the paddock, and just over 40 cows. All the usual buyers were operating, selling to a strong market. Prime Velas 509 to 560, heavy trade yearling steers 10 better, 480 to 552. The heifer portion also dearer, 425 to 540. Feeder steers over 400 kilos, 2 dearer, 490 to 586. Heifers to feed, much dearer, average 495. Wiener steers to restockers didn't quite reach the highs of last week. Quality related, 501 to 772. Heifers returning to the paddock slipped 12, 530 to 638. Heavy grown steers, 385 to 470. Grown heifers up to 22 cents dearer, 360 to 450. Heavy 3 and 4 score cows, price unchanged, 350 to 410. The best heavyweight bull reached 359 cents per kilogram. This is David Kent at Mossvale for MLA.
And that's the markets for today. And the last word goes to Mark at Duns Creek. He says he loves Stone and Wood beer, but it's a shame to see it sold to Mitsubishi, which owns Kirin and also owns Lion. Can't blame them, though. He says it's a nice earner for the founders. On the Country Hour, it's time for the news.